Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. I have with me today Jo-Jan Jonker. He's from the Netherlands, and he's been on the show several times before. And as I've always said about Jo-Jan, we love talking to each other, and this is a wonderful experience for me, and it's great that you listeners then get to listen in on our conversations. Jo-Jan is a great researcher of Reiki, and, you know, his main thrust in the last years has been this this aspect of our practice called mystic order. And through that, he has gotten a master's degree and now is working on his doctorate degree in spirituality, which I find fascinating, just that to begin with. And then to understand that what he's declared as his spiritual practice is Reiki, which some Reiki masters have tried to do in other countries and for other different degrees, but it hasn't worked because educational institutions haven't been able to recognize Reiki as a spiritual practice. So perhaps we can start with that, Jo-Jan. Welcome to the show again.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Yeah, and tell me, am I accurate that you're getting a doctorate in spirituality?
Well, to be accurate, it is a doctorate in the field of the study of religions.
Ah, religions.
Because spirituality in itself is not yet a field where you can get a PhD degree in. So
right.
It's more or less a specialization within the study of religions, of religious studies.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
And then do you have to declare your religion?
No.
No.
No. That's the field of the study of religious study covers all religions that are thinkable of.
Well, and so your thesis, which is based on Reiki, the Reiki practice, is okay for them.
Yeah, that's okay for them.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Because my supervisor, he's a professor in Asian religions in general, so that means also Hinduism and Buddhism, and he has in academia, it is noticed that traditions that have emerged in the East have changed when they come in the West, or are changing when they are in the West. And that has happened with Buddhism. And he is interested if something similar has happened to Reiki. So that is his personal interest for and his reason to supervise me.
Interesting. So can you share with us then what the basic premise of your thesis is?
The basic premise is the research question: what happens to the spirituality of Reiki during its migration from East to West?
Mm-hmm. And do you have a theory?
The theory is that a given spirituality of a religion, but also of a certain spiritual movement, like for instance Reiki, is influenced on the world view of the practitioners, and the world view is itself influenced by the culture people live in.
Uh-huh.
And so the assumption is, the idea is that when a given spirituality, whether it is Reiki or not, when it emerges in one country in a certain cultural setting, and then it migrates to another country in another cultural setting, the idea is that things change. And the question is, what is changing? And why is it changing? So first of all, is it changing? And if so,
right,
what has changed? And then why has it changed?
Mm-hmm. So could you give us an example in another practice, or?
Well, if you look at Buddhism, when Buddhism entered is not the right way, but came a practice in the West, it was from the beginning on completely emancipated. Men and women were treated equally.
Ah, I see. Mm-hmm.
While in the East, up until today, if a boy from 10 years old enters a monastery to become a monk, then he is, after his first initiation, he is in regarded on a higher level than a female priest who has been there for 20 years.
Really?
And in the West, that is completely skipped.
Uh-huh.
And this is, for instance, an example that has to do with the culture, because in the West we have already a whole process of emancipation between men and women.
Right.
But this is just an example where you can see the influence of a culture.
That's fascinating.
Or something else that Buddhism is often called, that every Buddhist is a pacifist. But that is not necessarily the case with Buddhists in the East. There are Buddhists who know very well how to fight a war.
Right.
So that's something else there are differences between cultures that somehow reflect on the practice.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. So, you want to study Reiki as it was practiced by Mikao Usui and that generation, and then compare that to what it is today?
Yes. I have divided this study in three time periods. It is what I call the Japanese period, from around, let's say, 1900 up until either 1940 when Hayashi died, or 1945 when the Second World War ended. And then the second period is the Hawaiian North American period, and it covers mostly the time period from 1938, that Takata became the Reiki master, up until 1975, when she, I think it was 75, when she started to train Reiki masters.
Right.
And this is a specific period. And after that, so let's say since 1980, it really took off, due to the globalization.
Right.
And this is then the third time period that I take into consideration. And the Japanese period is obviously the most difficult to get a picture of. I have read a lot about the situation in the country back in those days, and of the numerous new religious movement that came on the market in those days, and what what way Reiki was the same and in what way Reiki was different from all the others, and there are dozens of them.
And yes, there are.
So this is one part, but it remains difficult to pinpoint exactly what Usui spirituality, or what the spirituality was from the earliest Reiki practitioners, for the simple reason that you cannot interview anybody. So it's more a reconstruction. So I think at the end, I cannot say this was the spirituality, but I can, when I can say something, it was most likely this spirituality, or it's an indication that it has to be something like that and that. And then when we are going on in time, it becomes much easier, because from the present time, I can interview people and ask questions to various people. So that makes it easier.
Interesting. So
I hope so.
Yeah, it is very interesting.
For me, it is extremely interesting. Absolutely. Yes.
Uh-huh.
because it's it gives so much general background information about the time period that Uzui lived in.
Right.
To start, when I started with Reiki, I had no idea about the history of Japan, and I had a more or less romanticized picture from that everything was in peace and at ease, and everything was going smoothly. And when I started to read all the literature about this time period, and I saw that there were multiple crises, I think, oh my goodness, it was a very complex time to live in.
It was very complex. I mean, they went from a feudal system, you know, with bows and arrows, basically, for weapons, to modern weaponry and somehow moving out of that into a totally different political structure in just a few years, literally. And
precisely.
So I call this period of time, for me, a revolution and a renaissance all at the same time. And it depends on who you talk to in the moment, what they thought. Because for a lot of the Japanese, of course, the traditionalists wanted it to all stay the same. As usual, there are those people. And then there were those people who really wanted it to change and were part of the change. And my guess is that Mikao Usui was a part of the change. Would you say that was true?
Yeah, otherwise he would not have started his own movement.
Yes. But do you think in your research that he really intended to start a movement, or it was a personal search?
I think it was both. Given this, but this is a calculated guess, so to speak.
Oh, okay.
Because I have not interviewed Usui. Unfortunately, he's already deceased, as you know. But given the fact that there was an economical crisis and a social crisis and a religious, spiritual crisis, all happening at the same time, and if the research done by other people are correct, and that indeed in Usui had different occupations that went not so good or half. He wasn't that successful in his occupation for one reason or another, and he had to face the crisis in his own life one way or another. And maybe that as I call it, the toolkit that he had to cope with all those difficult circumstances wasn't adequate enough, because there were so many crises at the same time. So in general, that was the reason that so many new religious movements could emerge, because they promise some kind of way out of all this misery. And Usui did more or less the same. And so he did it for himself and for others. That's more or less what I think now. And it can change next week because I'm still working on it. But
right.
this is the picture that I have today.
Uh-huh.
And it is not carved in stone yet.
Uh-huh. So do you feel like this takes away from the history as we know it and creates another motivation? Do you know what I mean?
What part of the history are you referring to?
Well, just the very motivation of his going off and searching for the answer to a burning question he had inside him. In fact, it makes it not an inspired journey, but a calculated one. And I don't know if I really like that idea.
Well, I think it's both. I think there's an interaction between the inspiration and the necessity of it.
Yeah.
That this also in the West, when everything is going perfectly well with people, they most of the time are not that interested in picking up a certain kind of spirituality. Most of the times people start with a spirituality or a religion or whatever when something is happening. So, and then you start, then people start reading or start listening to other people and get inspired. And that is the interaction. So I think that when the oral tradition says that he was inspired by the stories of healing in the Buddhist tradition and in the Christian tradition, that still stands. There's no reason that it should be not true. And on the other hand, is why was he inspired? And that may have to do because he lived. He had also had to face and cope with all kinds of crises in the society at that time. And that's what I mean by the interaction.
Yes, I just have to say, from my point of view, just from my point of view, it's, I think, very dangerous, and is one of my things about our research today about, you know, reading into anybody's motivation of what they've done in the past, even my grandmother, I actually don't know what the priorities are and how they would cope with certain things. So when you said, well, like today, this is what would happen, I think you can't assume that he would have the same response, that's all.
That's correct. We don't know that.
So it is too bad that we can't interview him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that is really too bad.
So what would be next then in your... So I'm just wondering if there's a way to come into contact with people who might have a different take on the reaction of a certain group of people. Like, so I tell you what I'm thinking about. I don't know if this association is still around, and it would be great if it was. But, you know, Foka went to the Oomoto Institute, and he would have to tell you where this is in Japan, because he took me the first time I went to Japan, but, you know, I was in a fog, so I have no idea where we went, actually. And what they've done is that they're, do you know about the Oomoto Institute?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if they would be able to give you more of a, like a guess from the Japanese side of what might have gone on at the time, taking into consideration because they were considered rebels, you know, in their, and they lived at the same time, and they were considered to be rebels, and they had to like hide for a while during this time period because they might be thrown in jail.
Yes, that's correct. And I have contacted them for another reason, because some sources, not academic sources, but books that are written within Reiki literature, suggested that Usui might have been a member of Oomoto. So I wrote them, and they wrote back that this question of Usui was a member of Oomoto was, they had it on several occasions, and once again for me, they took a look at their archives, and they could nowhere find any relation to Usui. So But I'm aware that Oomoto had a different approach on the difficulties that there were in the society. That's true, and that's the reason why there are so many. There were many answers on the same questions at that time. That's true.
Yeah. So I just wondered that if, I mean, they lived. They were founded around the same time, and they lived in that same era, and you might get insight into what their response was and apply that possibility to your surmising of Mikao Usui.
That's yeah.
Because the Japanese mind, I mean, you know, I'm Japanese, but I'm definitely American in my thinking. And it creates a lot of misunderstanding. I mean, even with my own family about motivation and what we're doing and so on, because we all are westernized in a different to a different degree, right? So
yeah, absolutely.
And it makes for a very, I don't know, maybe everybody has these issues with family, but for me it makes understanding sometimes motivations of my family members very different, especially the ones that are in Hawaii, because they come also from a totally another culture, which is Hawaiian Japanese. And I can't use my assumptive powers to assume what they're doing, because they have a totally different priority.
Yeah. Well, to some extent, it's also visible within conferences of the Reiki Alliance. They can already see differences in cultures.
That's true.
And then that's about today. And all more or less westernized people. and all Reiki practitioners. And nevertheless, there are differences in culture to be seen.
Uh-huh. So I have a question for you. How do you hope to come to a place where it feels authentic for you?
For the Japan era, this is...
For all the eras.
Yeah, and what do you mean by authentic then?
Well, authentic meaning that it doesn't come from your own idea of what it was, that it comes from a more authentic human place. So I'm not talking about true in the sense of factuals. I'm more talking about authentic in the sense of how... When you make generalizations, it has to, you know, for me, it has to come from an authentic place. Like the interviewers, the interviews that you do, even on people that are living today, how will this influence your own preconceptions of what you think you will find? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I try to have no preconceptions in the first place. And one of the reasons that my supervisor accepted me as a PhD candidate is because he noticed during the writing of my master thesis that I, for one reason or another, was able to, as we called it, to step in and step out of the tradition. And stepped in is what I mean when I'm giving a Reiki class, and then I'm a Reiki master, and that's it. And I have no questions about the history of Reiki or whatever. Then I am a Reiki master as I always was. And when I've stepped out, I'm the researcher. And then also I'm stepping out of my own tradition and my own practice.
Uh-huh. And he noticed that was an ability you had.
Yes. And we also talked about how is it possible that one can do that? I'm not the only one, obviously. But it has to do also with kind of feeling secure and feeling safe that because when you step out of your own tradition, it can give uncertainty, because it leaves the possibility open that you have to reconsider your assumptions of your own tradition and your own practice.
Right, exactly.
And so it needs a little bit of courage to step out and be a researcher and to accept the possibility that indeed some of your own preconceptions change as a result of the research. For some reason, I'm not afraid of death. Because, and I think it has to do with when I'm stepped in, I'm very happy with the Reiki as it is today, with the system of Fusumi Kuriyoho and with the four aspects and nine elements. It works perfectly for me. So I have no reason to change that for myself. And this is the system as it is today. So regardless what the outcome is of my research, it doesn't change my personal practice.
Uh-huh.
And as a researcher, well, who knows, maybe the whole history, but then we're talking about the history, has to be rewritten. And I said, well, so what?
Uh-huh.
Does it answer your question?
Yeah, totally. That was beautiful. Thank you. Very clear. So now I'm wondering, that brings me to the next question. How did he get that about you? Do you know, is it because it was an observation that he made from his personal experience of you, or the way that you wrote your paper?
He knew me during the study. It's before that I wrote my thesis, so he knew me a little. And they have had some negative experience that there were students who practiced some kind of practice and wanted to prove their preconditions.
Ah, I see.
And from a scientific point of view, that's not correct. Then you are biased to start with.
Right.
For some reason, he noticed that I had a certain openness to take a look from what I'm doing and what I'm practicing, and that somehow he did not notice any fear in stepping out, and that was a basic need for doing research like this. Otherwise, you're biased, and it's not possible. Then indeed, if it would guide me by my own
preconceived notions,
then I would already have an answer and write my way to the answer.
Right, exactly.
That's not the way to do it. You have to be completely open for all possible outcomes.
Uh-huh. Beautiful. Thank you. That's very clear, and it's wonderful. So I'd like to step back and have you give us just a little bit of a summary of your master's thesis, because probably people are going to say, well, I wonder what his master's thesis was on. So can you do that for us, and then we'll go forward again.
Okay. Well, it is published in English now, so in principle, it's accessible for the English people part of the world. English, what did I say? English talking, speaking part of the world. Anyway, my master's thesis. Well, it all started that I am very interested in the special experiences that people have during Reiki treatments, or because they practice Reiki more in general, and that a lot of people call certain experiences mystical. And in those days, when I asked to five people from, what is mysticism and what is spirituality and what is mystical experience, I got at least five answers, but most of the time I ended up with 10 answers. So that was not the way to get to an answer for myself, and so I had to approach this mysticism thing from more theoretical point of view. So I ended up in a study at the university in the Netherlands, where they gave a lecture, where they gave a lecture on spirituality, and where you could do your master in spirituality. And I thought, well, that's it. And when I started this study, I already had the idea to write a master thesis on mystical experiences of Reiki practitioners. And in the beginning, they said, yeah, well, we'll see. And I also said, yes, well, you will see.
Great.
And so it happened. And in 2010, I could finish this study with a master thesis on mystical experiences of Reiki practitioners. And it was a specific group, because I had to exclude all kinds of possible biases. So it became a group of Dutch Reiki masters, all within the system of Suzuki Ryoho. And so it was, and because nobody, there was not one definition or description of mysticism that covered that covered everybody's needs. So the decision is made to ask one open question to the participants, from, okay, just share with me your most beautiful, exciting, mind-blowing, mystical, spiritual, whatever experiences, and what you consider as mystical experiences. So I left it open. And out of that came a lot of stories. I think it was, what was it, 70 stories or something, 17 people who provided me with 70 stories. It ended up that 17 people submitted 70 stories.
All right.
So that was something to, it was quite substantial in a way. And
excuse me for interrupting, but that is really amazing that out of 17 people, you got 70 stories.
Yes,
And that's amazing. That must be some significant, what's it called? Statistical, experience, huh?
Yeah,
significant. Well, because, in everyday life, we might say that if somebody has one mystical experience in their life, that would be pretty amazing. But these people obviously had many.
Yes. Most of them submitted more than one story. That's true.
That's amazing. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
And well, one of my assumptions was, or my hypothesis was, that taking in account that most of us consider Reiki rooted in a Buddhist history or a Buddhist context, that in those mystical experiences, quite some Buddhist things would be noticeable. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It was, I made the observation that when you divide it into Christian experiences, Buddhist experience, and New Age experience, to keep it simple, and that most of them were New Age experiences. And on the other hand, so that was one of the outcomes, and one of the other outcomes was that I consider Reiki not as a New Age spirituality, but as a holistic health spirituality.
Well, that's interesting.
That's the summary of the summary. It's the shortest version.
Well, what do you consider Reiki to be? Tell me again.
Not a New Age spirituality, but a holistic health spirituality.
Okay, can you explain more of that?
Well, the difference is that the New Age movement, as it started in the U.S. in the 60s, 70s, was more started as a protest movement. And while the holistic health movement more is a group of people who are interested in their personal development. So this is quite a difference between those two groups. I think that most Reiki practitioners, as I witnessed them during that writing of the master thesis, not started with Reiki out of protest, but because they wanted some kind of personal development one way or another, or some kind of healing. And so this is a major difference between those two groups. And there are some things that are shared by both in their worldviews. But for me, it was a reason. For me, there were a few reasons, and this was one of them, to label Reiki as a holistic health spirituality. And the holistic part was easily to be seen because in those stories, body as well as mind as well as spirit came along several times.
Mm-hmm. I've just been, since you've said, out of, what did you say, out of resistance or something? So I was trying to figure out, you know, if I felt like that to be true for myself. Then I realized that, you know, a lot of people, and what I say in my Reiki classes is that Reiki landed in California, which I consider to be the hub of the New Age movement in the 1970s. And one of the things that gave people an answer to question was, I don't like the old religions and the old religious practices, so I want to find something new. And whether they consciously knew it or not, they were drawn to Reiki. This other people's question was, I don't like the traditional medicine. I don't like what's happening. I don't like the authority that the medical community has over my life and over my health. So I want to find something different. And is that what you mean by in, from resistance?
Yes. And your answer indicates that perhaps Reiki started more as a New Age movement, but evolved into a more in a holistic health movement.
Well, I wouldn't say started, because if you're talking about Mikao Usui, I feel like
that's totally different.
But when you talk about the 1970s and 80s and the explosion of this practice globally, then yes, I feel like it answered, you know, a lot of questions. And then there was the other question, kind of the third road, so to speak, which was that, you know, families were starting to disintegrate. The World War II brought about the collapse of a society that had been worldwide in different countries that had been built up through all these different hierarchical agencies. Like, there was class systems everywhere, right? I mean, I've been watching Downton Abbey, this wonderful series about England during this time period and how structured their society was. And, you know, the war came and just crumbled that. And, you know, there's still, I think that we are all still recovering from that crumbling, because what came about with the collapse of our traditional hierarchical family structure and social structure came a free-for-all. And there needed to be some kind of way to find our own way individually through this debris, really, of latent emotions and how do we express our emotions, how do we communicate authentically, all these questions. And Reiki also answered that question, you know, by saying, let's just be ourselves, you know, let's just be human. And I think that it was a really interesting image to have Hawaii Ōtikata hold this all these years as mostly a physical healing practice, knowing that there was all this underneath, there were gifts underneath this practice that she couldn't talk about or she didn't want to talk about, and then presenting it in California in the 1970s, and allowing it just to filter out and answer all these questions for us.
Yeah.
So amazing that you took this on. I mean, I think that it's pretty I'm always very admiring of you and your how you look at things and how neutral you can be. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. So your master's thesis, sorry. So in the Netherlands, your idea is that people took Reiki not out of resistance, but out of...
Well...
Is that right? Is that what you said?
I think that a lot of people were looking for an alternative way to cope with their personal things in life. And that often those are physical things, but also very often it's more on the mental level, from how do you cope with the madness of the day?
Right.
How do you live your life in some pleasant way?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the emotional and mental benefits of Reiki are as much or not more appreciated than the physical healing capacity of Reiki.
Interesting.
But it may have to do that compared with the 1920s of Usui in his days, that the biomedicine of today can achieve much more than in the 1920s, obviously. So maybe that has to do, but I have not looked into that one, but maybe it has to do that because of that Western medicine is also improving, that the need for the physical healing for Reiki is less than it was in Usui's days.
Well, that opens up a kind of can of worms, so I'll just avoid it. By saying that what I referenced it to was, I thought that you said when you were talking about your master's thesis that in the United States, when Reiki first came to the when Reiki really came to the mainland and took off in the 1970s, that you felt that people were looking for a way out, that they were looking for something that they wanted out of resistance, or I think that's the word you used. And in the Netherlands, you felt like that was not the case.
Well, not less the case. Because in the Netherlands, it was a little bit later, because then we are already in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see today, there is some resistance against the pharmaceutical industry and against biomedicine, but most of the Reiki practitioners that I know, make use of the regular health system, and they see Reiki as an additional, not a replacement for the regular health system, but in addition to the regular health system. It's a complementary and not an alternative therapy for the most of them.
Yes, but that's totally a personal choice, right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely.
And I feel like that's also true in the United States. And actually, for me, there was a real confusion up until, I don't know, just a few years ago, of the difference between complementary and alternative. And recently I've been talking to researchers who make a very clear distinction about the difference between complementary, which means Reiki in as a complement to traditional allopathic medicine, and then alternative, meaning that they choose Reiki instead of traditional allopathic medicine. So I think that I've come to realize that there's another step that's being taken, if I can kind of be on this, it's a little bit of a a side road, that now what we're seeing is dropping these two terms and coming to something called integration. integrative medicine where the person is offered all these different possibilities of treatment, and they choose their own formula for themselves.
Yes, I totally agree. Yeah, and this also gives more room for a person's own worldview.
Yes.
And they can pick out the therapies that that fits the best to their own worldviews.
Yes. So now to get back, so we're going to reel ourselves in and go back to your doctorate thesis, which I'm very interested in, because we now have your master's thesis, and if people want more information, they can go to your to another interview. I'll have to look this up and see which interview it was that you actually spoke about this, the mystical experiences and so on.
And then they can check if they tell the same story.
Right. No, they can just have more detail.
Okay.
So in your doctorate thesis, I'm just wondering, what have you been doing? I have to gather myself. So you've been doing research, and I'm wondering, what does that research entail? I know that you took a trip to Japan, and was that a part of your research of your thesis?
Yes, it was a part of the research. not in the way that I am going to write down things about this trip in the thesis, but it's more about getting some awareness of the Japanese culture, even if it is today, and that we are talking about Japanese culture in the 1920s, it doesn't matter, but it's such a completely different world from the Western world.
Yes.
Even today. And what I've read is that it was also very complex and even more difficult and more different from the Western world back in the 1920s.
Absolutely.
And what I also wanted to witness is how, even today, how Shinto and Buddhist practices are completely integrated in daily life.
Yes.
And it seems that the process of secularization that we have in the West is also visible in Japan, but not to the same extent at this moment than we are experiencing it in the West. And that was very interesting for me to observe, to see that people literally were doing shopping and then passed by a Shinto shrine and just went in, did their prayer, and went on with their shopping.
Right.
As easy as that.
Yes.
And sometimes you see it in the West also, where the people enter a Roman Catholic church and light a candle, but it's in Japan, it's so much more normal and practiced by so much more people. And that was, for an example, and how far that even today goes on. For instance, our Japanese guide, at some point we visited somewhere a temple. And I noticed that they were renovating it, and I smelled that they were using new wood. And so I asked the Japanese guide from, hey, in the Netherlands, when you want to restore something, an old building, you have to reuse the old wood as much as possible. And I expect that it's the same in Japan, but sometimes you have to use new wood and new timber. But he said, well, but there is, because he knew what we were interested in, and then he told us that if they use new timber for restoring a temple, they take care of it, that the tree that is used for the restoration, the wood for the tree used for restoration, comes from the same forest as where the old trees came from originally. Because he says, even when a tree is cut down, there's still the kami of the tree.
Yes.
And it belongs to the Kami of the wood. And in the wood of the temple, it has to be the same wood belonging to the same Kami. And he said that they have the experience that when wood is used from different places for restoration, it doesn't last as long as when they're using the proper wood. So that is just one example how visible it is that Shinto practice is so vividly today.
Right. These are wonderful stories. Thank you, Yoyan, because it brings me to a place of saying it's difficult for me to imagine that Mikao Usui's, if I see the result of Mikao Usui's search for this burning question inside, whatever that question was, it was definitely a part of his personal journey, that, you know, his worry about having money would have anything to do with it is just, it doesn't seem very likely.
No.
That's all. So, it's just my, you know, it's really interesting to put these things together. And, I will be very interested in your continued research. And of course I have my own, I'm not as neutral as you are, obviously. And at the same time, I'm fascinated by your attempt to do this. I think you have the right mind and the right personality to pursue this. So I'm wondering, what are you going to do as far as the next step of your research after your Japan visit? Will you go back again? Or I'm just wondering if you have other plans or people that you want to interview.
Well, if I go back, this time in Japan, my role was stepped out. It was more the researcher taking a close look at the Japanese society, but also obviously the places where Usui has been, so the place of his birth, and Mount Kurama and his graveyard. But I must say, when I go back, I will go back stepped in. And I really would like to stay a few weeks on Mount Kurama, because what struck me most of the visit in Japan was the visit at Kurama and more the energy that you could feel there.
Right.
It was as if, in my words, so this is a personal experience, personal expression, the Reiki that you can sense when you treat yourself or another person, and you could feel it there in the air. It surrounded you. It was all over the place. And that was for me very impressive. So I can imagine that if Usui felt the same, that he decided that had to be the spot for his 3 week, meditation. So if I go back, I like to go back to Mount Kurama and meditate for some time, but without the fasting, that I don't like.
I see. Well, you know, the thing of it is that, this mountain has been used by, you know, multi-generations of people to, be in that meditative space and to find, you know, their truth within, you know, whatever that truth happens to be. And, it's a really amazing place. So yes, I imagine that's true. I'm just wondering if you feel like he chose it because he felt the Reiki energy, or because it was a place where he knew that he would be supported to receive whatever gift he was going to receive in the moment.
The second part, definitely, I think. The first part, we do not know. We do not know what he felt energetically before his experience on Mount Kurama. I have no idea.
Nice.
But I can imagine that precisely what you say, that for centuries, this place is already a holy place and a power spot. And so I can imagine that he was inspired by even if he did not experience it by himself, he may have been inspired by the stories of other people who went on Mount Kurama. And also the concept that the three gods of light, power, and light, love, and power were worshipped on this mountain also may have attributed his reason to pick that specific mountain.
Mm-hmm. So this is the difference between you and I.
You were in America and I'm in the Netherlands.
No, it's not that difference. It may be because you're a man and I'm a woman. I have no idea. But, you know, in my cosmology of how this works, right?
Yeah.
He was studying and he had several places that he could choose. I mean, all over Japan.
Yes,
he didn't need to go just next door to the nearest place, right?
That's true.
Yeah. So, because there are these very sacred places all over Japan. So he chose this one, but was it through intuition or was it through calculation?
I have no idea.
Yeah. So, but it feels like in what you shared, it's more a thought process. And for me, it's more of an intuitive process. So maybe it was a combination of both.
Yeah.
But it's just amusing to me when I feel the response inside myself, I realize, oh, this is just a difference between you and I, and our way of seeing the world. So, I really like it, and it's why I think our conversations are so interesting for me. It's because I get the other end of the spectrum.
But we meet in between, so that's nice.
Yes. Well, Yo-Yan, I think that we are probably at the end of our hour, and it's been a fantastic discussion already, and I really look forward to your thesis being completed. So do you have a kind of vague idea about when that will be?
Oh, at least one and a half year.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a huge amount of work.
It is. And are you going to use your community in the Netherlands for more of the interviews for the modern era? Or are you going to do interviews globally?
I don't know yet. The emphasis of the Western world is the Netherlands. That's true, because I'm living in the Netherlands and it's the most easy accessible for me.
Yeah,
and it will in a way connects to the results of the master thesis.
Right.
So then it can be combined in one way or another. So I don't know if I'm going to interview people all over the place, but probably yes in the Netherlands.
Uh huh. Well, I hope that you are willing to go the next step if you're going to do this kind of broad sweep of these different eras and use Japan as, and the Japanese culture as the beginning and then the human culture, which I feel like Reiki is really developing in the world today, and be able to interview, people from, very different cultures, so that you can see the similarity of how Reiki has touched everyone.
Yeah, that is very interesting indeed. But the goal of a PhD is also that you must be able to limit it to some extent, so that you can, in fact, it's some kind of a proof
yeah.
that you can do a research like this.
Ah, I see. Mm-hmm.
It has to be limited to some extent, because otherwise you will never end it.
Then right.
you can go on and on. So I have to draw a line at some point. But when I'm finished, and when I finish this PhD, then I can go on research for the rest of the world.
Okay.
And
that's
this
a deal.
Is fully advised by my supervisor.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, that's a great explanation. Thank you very much, Yo-Yan, for sharing so beautifully. And I'm really touched by what you're doing, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Phyllis. It was a pleasure.
Great. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.